Welcome back, my fellow peanuts, and welcome to anyone who's new to the channel or to my podcast. Now, this podcast covers true crime cases that may not be suitable for young listeners. There may be graphic and violent content. Listener discretion has been advised. Now, I've never heard of today's serial killer. And when I say that, I may have heard of one of in particular the murders, but I haven't actually heard of him. So he's not as famous as most of the ones we've actually dealt with. So it made for a really interesting read, and watching the documentaries, I know that sounds really sadistic, but I'm hoping all of you actually know what I mean by that. But our state today is Idaho. I read a really cute and fun fact about Idaho that I want to share with you. Idaho produces 72 types of precious and semi-precious stones, and some of these stones are not even found anywhere else in this world. So I thought that was a pretty cool fact. Our serial killer today is going to be Joseph Edward Duncan III. Now, he would be on top of being a serial killer, he'd be a child molester. So please be aware for this podcast in particular, we may talk about those, so it may upset some of my viewers or my listeners. Now, I truly believe that Joseph may have been one of the most evil people I've ever read about. And in doing any of my research across these podcasts, he's just a really appalling and disgusting human being. And that's saying a lot to what we've actually talked about on this podcast before. So we're in for a bit of a bumpy ride for this one, guys. He was born in Fort Bragg, North Carolina on February 25th, 1963 to Joseph Edward Jr. and Lillian May Duncan. He was the fourth of five kids. He would have three older sisters and one younger brother. So his father was in the US Army, and the family would move out through a lot of his childhood, nationally as well as internationally, moving every year or so. But once his dad had retired from the Army, they would settle in Tacoma, Washington. Joseph's mum, Lillian, she was described as overbearing, and he would say that she abused him, and his brother would counteract that and say it never happened. He even been quoted saying, "I grew up in that household. I was not abused. Of all the allegations from our childhood, I'd say 99% of them are false." But then I found an article that directly contradicted what he had said. His sister, Sherry, she would testify at one of her brother's hearings of the abuse and that the kids had actually endured. Now, she would claim that their mum was obsessive about attending church and would also make the statement during the hearing when she was beating, "If you fought back, it was worse." In his case, he just took what she gave and kind of whimpered off to his bedroom. Another comment was made during one of those, another comment that was made was that she would rant and rave, and their dad was often the target or the subject of the ridicule and mockery. What we see a lot of in a lot of serial killers, guys, is this domineering, overbearing mother figure. I see it a lot in a lot of the reading that I do and a lot of the true crime documentaries that I watch. So we do seem to have a correlation between that mother and serial killer or son relationship, starting that fragmented mind already of, and it, look, I didn't get much about what abuse it was, but she did actually stand by him during his trials and stuff like that. So there's certainly a bit of contradiction to everything, but there had to be, or possibly he was born evil, but there had to be something that was possibly triggered. During Joseph's teenage years, his parents would end up ending their marriage. Not really a huge surprise, given it didn't really appear to be a really happy one. His older sisters would shortly leave the household and the home shortly after the divorce, but it would be him and his brother that would stay with their mum for a period of time. But Joseph would end up being the only one staying because Bruce, his younger brother, would decide to go and live with his dad. And during this time that Bruce was living with his father, he would actually remarry. So there would be a step component to this as well. So another blended family. And Joseph would attend Lakes High School, but he actually wouldn't graduate. An article that I've read said that his GPA was 1.7 out of a possible 4. Now, I'm not really sure that this is a measure of anyone's intelligence, what a GPA is, or is it just a lack of not wanting to do anything at school, or was there perhaps some stuff going on in his childhood home that prevented him from doing well in school? The reason that I make this comment is, and it's going to be discussed later on in the podcast, guys, he actually seems like he's quite intelligent. So I don't think this was a mark of where he was in school or that he was slow or anything like that. So I just wanted to, I guess, preface this with I don't think he was lacking in intelligence, and I don't think that's the reason why he didn't finish school. Before I do continue this next part of my podcast, it's another trigger warning, guys. We're going to be discussing crimes as a sexual predator, and his victims did happen to be children. Now, he would commit his first disgusting act at the ripe old age of only 15. Now, he would rape a little boy of the age of 9 at gunpoint. However, this crime, it wouldn't be discovered until a year later when he was arrested for driving a stolen car. Now, allegedly, there'd been a car chase and he would apparently run a police roadblock where he would crash the car. Now, he would sustain injuries to the right side of his face and even to his sinuses. But during this time, he'd be sentenced as a juvenile and he'd be sent to the Jesse Deislin Boys Ranch in Tacoma. Now, whilst I was looking up this juvenile facility, there's actually many allegations of sexual abuse of the juveniles that attended, which it re that just really broke my heart. Because, look, guys, those young minds are being sent to these homes for whatever reason. It could be a number of different reasons, and I'm not going to speculate anything, but it w was boys and girls that got sent to this particular ranch. And the allegations of the sexual abuse and the abuse, and it wasn't just in Tacoma, it was actually across the US. So if you do want to do a little bit more research, there's certainly a lot out there. There are lawsuits that are actually still pending. And this is not the first, and I really don't think it'll be the last time we hear about this type of abuse in these type of facilities. There's no allegations from Joseph or his family of the sexual abuse, of any sexual abuse done to him at this time. But I do wonder if he was witnessing that and that made him more of a predator, given what he possibly witnessed. It's really just food for thought, but I'm just speculating here whether that's actually what possibly triggered some even worse behaviors in Joseph. Now, returning to his story, during his time with his appointed therapist, he would actually admit that he'd sexually assaulted more boys and raped even more. Now, I can't confirm if this is true, but this is just what he would say at the time while he was in the boys' home. But given his already deviant behavior, I do honestly, I don't doubt it at all. The thing is, when you read a lot of these articles and you read a lot of the document, sorry, and you watch a lot of the documentaries, you do hear a lot. So I'm never entirely sure of whether they're grandeuring what they did or whether it's to big note themselves or in whatever way, shape, or form. Or there is a possibility that these boys were raped and they were sexually abused. Now, given the time that this existed, I'm not sure they would have felt comfortable, and I'm not sure it's easy for men to come forward when these or boys when ha this has happened to them. So I think there is a bit of a stigma that perhaps what we need to do is understand that this does happen, and what can we do as a society to make sure that this doesn't. In 1980, when Joseph was just 17, he would end up at the Western State Hospital, and that would be followed by a term in prison. And we're just going to get into a little bit of that detail now. Now, it all started with a simple robbing of his neighbor's house, and now he'd steal some guns, he would steal some ammunition. But the worst part is, he would steal some pornography. Now, he would originally intend to go home and enjoy that loot, whatever you want to take with that, guys. However, what he actually decided was he wanted a victim. As a result of this, so he'd come upon a 14-year-old boy and he would hold the boy at gunpoint with one of those stolen guns and take him to the woods, and he would beat and rape the boy. I'm not going to get into all of the details of what happened to that little boy because I just don't think I want to give it airtime. But once Joseph would return home, the police would actually be waiting for him already. Now, thankfully, he would plead guilty. And according to court documents, he would actually say, I held a gun to a Jew and forced him to commit certain sex acts. This was a part of his pleading guilty. He had to admit to what the crimes he'd actually committed. So that's why, in particular, that was in the court documents. Now, he'd originally be sent to a maximum of 20 years in prison, but the judge would grant, in lieu of prison, he'd actually be committed to a sex offender treatment program at the Western State Hospital. It's during this time at the State Hospital that it did really little help for his deviant behavior. He really didn't show any empathy for his victims, and he didn't show any remorse at all for his criminal behavior or what he'd done to these innocent children. And what he did say was the reason behind the rape of that particular 14-year-old boy was because he felt rejected from both of his parents, their recent separation, and he hadn't got into the Air Force because of that pesky little auto theft charge that he'd had just a couple of years ago. Now, shy of 2 years in the state hospital when Joseph was 19, the treatment program felt like they had very little to offer to him anymore. A therapist from there would even say, after 22 months in the program, Mr. Duncan has shown an unwillingness to modify his sexually deviant behaviors and has chosen to not commit himself to the program's techniques. They would also mention in the assessment that he would rebel against the treatment, and he would request himself to leave the program and serve out the rest of his sentence in prison. But a therapist would remark, he is not safe to be at large. Now, he'd end up serving out 14 years before being paroled, and he would be in and out of jail over the next couple of years from 1996. Now, for the next couple of minutes, I'm going to be discussing the victims that he was not charged with, in particular, Sammy Joe and Carmen, but he would confess to their murders. It just makes it a bit easier for the timeline if I go through the murders chronologically, and we're going to discuss what happens with Sammy Joe and Carmen. Now, he'd be tied to three murders, but he would not be tied to them until his arrest. Now, in July of 1996, Sammy Joe White, 11 years old, and Carmen Cubius, 9 years old, would leave their hotel where they were living with their mum and their siblings, and they'd be just going across the street to the Taco Time. Someone had requested that they go and get some cigarettes. They disappear from there in the time, like just straight across the road. Now, the police weren't sure if they were runaways or if something more serious had happened. Now, imagine that you've requested, I read that it was either her brother or her mum that had requested that the girls go and buy cigarettes for them from the Taco Time. I don't know why the Taco Time. Maybe they had like a vending machine. But they went across the road and then just never came back. And the police during that time, given that their lifestyle was nomadic, they just weren't sure that they'd just run off. Truly, truly a sad moment for that mum and her family. But in 1998, so almost 2 years later, Sammy Joe and Carmen's remains, they were found by a transient in an abandoned barn, near the area of Bothell. Now, the King County Medical Examiner's Office would say that the girls had been beaten with a crowbar, but they had been killed shortly after they disappeared, and that was just judging by the decomposition of their bodies. Now, he would confess, Joseph would confess to these murders, but they'd never be charged. There's not a whole lot of information in regards to why he wasn't charged, so I can't tell you a definitive reason for this. But in April 1997, Anthony Michael Martinez, he'd be playing outside with his friends and siblings just outside the front of his house, and a man would approach them with money and a poster of a missing cat. Now, two of the boys were a little bit, there was something off, so they were really scared and they'd run off. But Joseph would end up pulling out a knife and grab Anthony, and he'd flee with him, and leaving the other kids really just to watch in fear and really not know what to do. But after a 2-week search, Anthony's body would be found in Indio, California, and he'd be found nude and partially decomposed. this is really horrible, guys. It would actually be found out that he'd been sexually assaulted and he was bound with duct tape. But the boys that had witnessed the abduction, they give a really good description of the man and the car, but the police were able to provide that sketch to the public. But a partial fingerprint would be found on that duct tape. Now, this would lead to a conviction, which we will talk about later. But that sketch, I'm not sure if you can see it up on screen at the moment, but that sketch is up at the moment with a picture of Joseph beside it. And just look at that. That's pretty familiar. So that would be his undoing later, but we'll talk about that later. Now, Joseph would be arrested at some point in 1997 again for parole violations, and he'd actually have to finish out his sentence. And he'd be released in 2000 and be moved to Fargo, North Dakota. Now, while living there, he would attend the North Dakota State University studying computer science. Now, as soon as he arrived in Fargo, he was required to register as a sex offender. Now, he had not done this previously back in 1994 or something like that, or 1996, and it was considered a parole violation. So he would change his behavior and actually rock up to the police station, and he would register himself as a sex offender. Now, he would never raise any suspicions while living there. And in fact, the police chief, Chris Magnus, he would say, in many ways, he was almost a model offender in terms of his times here. Now, when I was watching a documentary, it actually talked about any time that a crime was committed, though, in that area that involved children. Unfortunately, he was one of the very first people that was looked at. Now, this is just given the fact that he was a registered sex offender, so they actually had to do their due diligence and do this. He got really upset at this and was just really like, well, if I'm not doing anything, then I may as well do something. So he sort of was a bit of a, he was damned if you do and damned if you don't. I don't think that was the case. Mate, you'd previously done some pretty despicable acts. What did you expect that they were going to do? Just let it slide and go, hey, you've changed completely? So for me, it's like, well, you just have to accept your reality, mate. But in April 2005, he would be charged with molesting two boys in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. This would occur in a playground about a year before in June in 2004. He would be granted bail of $15,000, and a businessman from Fargo who knew him would even assist in this. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, would he regret that decision. Now, Joseph would soon disappear after being granted bail, which would result in a federal warrant being issued in June 2005. Now, the next part of this podcast, it's been documented really, really well. It also has a really interesting documentary. People Magazine investigates the Grooney Family Massacre, if you're interested in watching or learning a little bit more. Before I begin, though, guys, the next topics, they do involve children's sexual abuse, and these can be very hard topics to watch and hear. I'm just going to take a sip of my coffee, sorry guys. But shortly after being granted bail, it appears as though he had already a plan in his mind to run. Maybe he didn't want to go back to jail. We'll never really know what his motives were, but what we do know is that he chose one of the worst ways to handle his freedom. Now, he would stop at a Walmart and he'd buy night vision goggles, a video camcorder, and somewhere along his travels, he would also purchase a shotgun, some shells, and a claw hammer. None of these things, in my mind, seem to be that he was planning anything good, or it just doesn't seem like he was planning on doing the right thing. But he would hire a Jeep in St. Paul, Minnesota, and never return it. He would use this rental car in his crimes, and you'll see the Jeep up on the screen as this video is running on in the background, guys. And the car company, they would report the car stolen, but the car wouldn't be found until later. But we're going to get to that. Now, he would drive through Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, but he would end up in Idaho for reasons really unknown. But some of his family was in Washington, so perhaps Idaho was meant to be just like a little stopover. Now, Joseph would somehow end up in the same area as the Bruni family, and from the documentaries that I've watched and articles that I've read, before he would kidnap two of the Bruni children, he would actually stalk them for a couple of days. Now, apparently he had seen Shasta and Dylan playing out in their front lawn, and really, good Lord knows how he found their home, because it's anywhere but remote. It's really, really remote, guys. Like, it's not somewhere where you can just come upon it. Now, seeing them piqued his interest, and this would lead to some really fatal consequences. And considering the remoteness of the home, I'm wondering if he initially saw them in town and then he would follow them. So we don't really have the information behind how he found the family. A lot of information and what I'm going to be talking about is actually from Shasta's own accounts. It's what she talked about after her kidnapping and his return to her family. Now, on the night of May 15th, Shasta would think before she was going to sleep that she'd actually already seen a man in her room, but she would be comforted by her brother and she would soon fall asleep. Now, she would be woken up by her mum. Her mum was in tears and clearly very, very distraught, and she was getting her out of bed and whispered, "Someone's in the house." Her mum would lead both the kids, Dylan and Shasta, to their lounge room, just as she'd been instructed to do. Shasta and Dylan would then witness their older brother, Slade, their stepdad, Mark, and their mum, Brenda, be bound by zip ties. Duct tape would be placed over their mouths and they were told to lay face down. The man in their house, he would be asked the kids to call him Jet. He was dressed in black. He had his night goggles on and a mask covering his face and was holding that shotgun. Now, Shasta would actually say at that young age, a shoulder-style weapon. When the shotgun was found, she was able to determine it was actually a shotgun. Now, both kids would be bound as well, but they'd be taken outside and told to lay down by the Jeep. While Shasta was waiting outside, she would recall hearing grunts and loud thumping. And what she really genuinely didn't realise was that she was listening to the murders and slaughter of her family. Now, Slade, her brother, he'd somehow make his way outside, like to the porch area, and Shasta would witness her own brother dying in front of her. Now, once Shasta and Dylan and Joseph had left, Slade would actually drag his body and drag himself into the house and die just beside his mum. I can't even imagine at the tender age of 8 years old, because that's how old Shasta was. She was 8 years old and Dylan was only nine, that they witness that level of violence. Like, that has got to stay with you. The next day, a neighbor was coming over to give Slade some money because he'd mowed the lawn the previous day. And he'd noticed that their cars were in the driveway, but no one had come up when he like pulled into the driveway, which is what was normally happen. And he knocked on the door and no one had come, which he just thought was really, really unusual for this particular family. He would have a really, really terrible feeling. And he'd return to his home and ring 911 and ask for a health check on the family. Now, the sheriff's department, they would arrive and they'd be shocked and disgusted by what they were about to witness in that home. They'd find blood everywhere. There were two bodies in the kitchen, puddles of blood under the bodies, just puddles of blood everywhere. What they were able to determine that it was a young man and a middle-aged woman, but they were unable to tell if the victims were shot, if it was blunt force trauma. They would end up finding a third body while they were continuing their way through the house. Once again, they weren't able to determine the cause of death, but the police suspected that this was a crime of passion, given the level of violence that had been inflicted on these victims. So they did initially suspect that it was someone who knew the family. Now, the deputies believed that the bodies did belong to the occupants of the house, and the victims in the kitchen, who would be identified as Brenda and Slade. Slade would be only 13 years old, and the other victim would be Brenda's partner, Mark McKenzie. Now, there were no signs of the two other children, Shasta and Dylan. An Amber Alert was issued almost immediately after those bodies had been found, and searches for those kids would begin really, really quickly. And in parallel, those police would continue to process the scene. It would be found that all of those victims had been beaten with that claw hammer. So those noises that she was hearing was her family being beaten to death. But Joseph had quite the head start on the police. Now he'd take the two children to the Lolo National Forest in Montana, and he'd move them around to different campsites to ensure that he couldn't get caught. Now, what he would do to these two children is just unspeakable. And there are some things, guys, that I just won't talk about. I don't want to give it airtime. I don't want to give it a voice. But what I will say is he did torture them physically, mentally, and sexually for almost 6 weeks. He would even describe to Shasta and Dylan what he'd done to their family, even though he'd been telling them the whole time that their family was alive and that they could be returned to them and they were all safe. The reason he did this, though, was it was to scare them. It was not an act of, you know, maliciousness or anything like that. It was an act to say, hey, this is what will happen to you if you run away. An appalling and disgusting human being. Now, the next part is really horrific, guys. And this is even worse that a child had to witness it. Towards the end of that 6 weeks, Shasta, she would be on one side of the Jeep and Dylan and Joseph would be on the other. And all of a sudden, she would hear a very loud boom. And in the next moment, all she could hear was her brother Dylan screaming and breathing in pain. And when she looked at him, she could see there's a hole and his insides were coming out of it. Joseph would say that the gun went off by accident and he hadn't meant to hurt Dylan, and he would then shoot him in the head, claiming that he was putting him out of his misery. Now, I don't know if he really was shot out of accident. Apparently he was getting something out of the Jeep and it went off. I don't know if it's because he wanted Shasta to himself, but if that's what he wanted, that's one of the most disgusting things he could have ever done. Now, he would follow this up by doing something as equally awful. After witnessing your own brother's death, he'd ask the 8-year-old Shasta how she wanted to die, by gun or strangulation. And after all that she'd had to endure, you ask her how she wants to die. Now, Shasta, God, she's this incredibly brave child. She'd pick strangulation. She would say in a statement, though, that she didn't want to endure as much pain as her brother had, and also that she just had a gut instinct that to pick that. For whatever reason, she just said she just had a moment of clarity that pick that. And while he was strangling her, and with her last breath, she would actually call out Jet. Little did she know at the time, she just saved her own life. Now, it would be the next part of her ordeal that just would prove how incredibly brave and smart she was. She had a real will to live, this little girl. He would tell her after she called him Jet, I don't know why, but when you call me back, I can tell you really care about me. And during one of the documentaries that I watched, Shasta said, at that point, I knew that I'd gained a lot of trust in him and I was pretty much going to do whatever it took to survive. So from there on out, she would tell him parts of her life, like things she liked to do when she was growing up, places she'd gone on holidays with her parents and places that she wanted to show him, just and things like her school. Brave girl, just the amount of resilience that it took and what this girl had inside her. I'm floored by her courage, absolutely floored. Now, Joseph would ask her if she wanted to meet his mum, who lived in Washington. Now, she would reply yes, but on one condition, if they could go through her hometown so she can show him where she went to school. Now, this would be one of Joseph's biggest mistakes. Sorry, I'm just going to stop and have a coffee again. Because they would stop at a Denny's on this little trip to go see his mum. Now, on July 2nd at around 1:30 in the morning, 48 days after the Grooney family had been so brutally murdered, Joseph and Shasta, they would exit a Jeep and head into a Denny's. Now, two of the men outside were smoking. One of them almost immediately recognised Shasta. Now, after all, there had been billboards and lots of airtime featuring her and her brother. Now, this young man, he would notify his girlfriend, but he didn't need to do anything because the waitress inside serving those two was already all over it. 911 would be called and little Shasta would be safe and she'd be returned to her family. Now, Joseph Edward Duncan, he'd be arrested with very little commotion. So there wasn't much. He didn't fight it at all. Now, I read an article where his brother claimed that Joseph wanted to be caught, and that's why he took her back to her hometown. Now, a direct quote from Bruce, "I knew from day one he didn't get caught by accident. He was in another state. He could have gone 500 different directions, yet he took Shasta back." There is something to be said in that, right? Because he did have that opportunity to take her anywhere else, but he took her there. So I think it was a little bit of Shasta being incredibly brave and saying, "Hey, I want to live with you," and all that kind of stuff. But I also think there was some part of him that maybe did want to get caught. But I don't know. I'm speculating here. Now, the healing process would begin for Shasta. Now, she would live with her dad and she would recover in her own way. But I am going to quote directly from the documentary now, just because I do think we need to hear her voice, right? We need to hear her resilience and how she went through it. "It felt weird being in a house with my mum, with my dad and his girlfriend, with none of my brothers. I was just so alone. He was a truck driver, so it was very seldom that we saw him. And that's how he paid the bills, though. I also became really sensitive about my weight and the things that I ate. And I think it was a way to punish myself. I developed an eating disorder at a really young age. If I ate, I made myself throw up. I then started self-harming. I was hiding a lot from my dad. And then he got throat cancer and he almost died from it. So much has happened that I never fully got to heal. I had promised my brother Dylan that I would make sure that we got out alive. And I carried out so much guilt because he didn't live, but I did. Else, I felt like it should have been the other way around. I handled all of that in very unhealthy ways. I started drinking at the age of 13, smoking marijuana, hanging out with older people. I was trying to numb everything. And there was a possibility that my dad might die. And I didn't know what to do." I can't even imagine having to live my life after what she had endured. So whatever measures she took to start the healing process, I don't think anyone gets to judge her. And least of all people who don't understand. She's got two beautiful kids now. She's living her very best life. So whatever steps got her to where she is today, leave her be. That's all I say. Now, Joseph Duncan, he'd be convicted in three courts, an Idaho state court for the kidnapping and murders of Brenda and Slade Rooney and Mark McKenzie. Now, the federal courts, the charges would be 10 separate counts, kidnapping resulting in death, aggravated sexual abuse of a minor, sexual exploitation of a child resulting in death, and charges related to the illegal firearm possession and vehicle theft. And finally, a California Superior Court for the kidnapping and murder of Anthony Martinez. Now, the reason there was federal charges is because he took the two children across across state lines. So that immediately becomes a federal. Now, in Idaho, he would first appear in a county court in July 2005. Now, he would be charged with the three counts of first-degree murder and three counts of first-degree kidnapping. So he would be initially charged at a state level for those kidnappings, and he would be charged with first-degree murder of Brenda Slade Rooney and Mark McKenzie. Now, the prosecutors, they'd initially planned to charge Joseph with all of the charges that came with the federal, but they realised that transporting children across state lines for the purpose of sexual exploitation is actually a federal offence, so they couldn't do it at a state level. Now, the trial was set to begin in January 2006, but it was delayed until April. After one of the judges, they granted a request for the defence to have more time to prepare for the trial. But again, in October, after the judge in the case stated, no one wants to try this case twice, including me. So your attorneys, you're being blamed at the moment for postponing because the prosecution want to insist on pursuing the death sentence. But in October of 2006, shortly after jury selection began, the prosecutors and Joseph's attorneys themselves, they reached a plea agreement in which he pled guilty to all of the charges that were against him. Now, he was immediately sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences without possibility of parole. And then for those kidnapping charges, he was charged with an additional 3 life sentences. Now, sentencing was also dependent on some of those federal the outcomes of the federal trial. So they were just making sure, because there was a possibility that the death penalty was involved in the federal. Now, he would return to another hearing, like the penalty phase, on those murder charges, but 2 years later he'd be sentenced to death on those federal charges. But he did agree at the time to assist the sheriff's department on crimes that he'd previously done, and he would give passwords to all of his encrypted files on his computers. I don't want to get into what was found on those computers. It's just disgusting. But in 2007, he'd be indicted by a federal grand jury in Coeur d'Alene on those 10 counts of kidnapping resulting in death, aggravated sexual abuse of a minor, and sexual exploitation of a child resulting in death, and the crimes relating to the illegal firearm possession and vehicle theft. Now, he would be arraigned the following day in Boise, where a judge would order him to stand in March. The defense would immediately request a postponement. That would be granted, and the trial would start not until, I believe it was January 2008. But a month before it was due to start, he'd actually plead guilty again to all 10 charges. But a condition of this agreement was specific that Shasta Grooney would not have to testify in the penalty phase of the trial. Now, due to a gag order, we actually don't have any of those other agreements because it's a gag order. But jury selection for the penalty phase in the federal charge would begin in April 2008. And during jury selection, he would actually dismiss his attorneys and he wanted to represent himself. His attorneys immediately objected, imagine that, asserting that he wasn't competent. Like, they said, no, he's not competent. But during a formal hearing, it was actually determined that he was quite competent. And so he would proceed to that penalty phase without counsel. After about 3 hours of deliberation, the jury, they would recommend the death penalty. And the judge would impose 3 death sentences for kidnapping resulting in death, sexual exploitation of a child resulting in death, and the use of a firearm in a violent crime resulting in death. Now, all of those related to Dylan Grooney. And in November 2008, he was sentenced to an additional 3 consecutive terms of life without parole in federal prison for what he'd done to Shasta Grooney and the sexual abuse that Shasta and Dylan had to endure. The jurors in that particular trial, or who they'd imposed the death sentence, they were offered counselling after that horrific evidence. It actually included a 33-minute video of what he'd done to Dylan. I'm not going to get into the details of what was in that video. I'm sorry, guys. I just think it's absolutely appalling, and I don't think we need to discuss it. Now, Joseph, his counsel that he removed, they would actually file a notice of appeal. And Joseph would write to the court and inform that the appeal was, he didn't want it, and it was taken against his wishes. So in 2011, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the district court's decision to permit Joseph to represent himself without holding a hearing as to his competence, and he would be remanded until, oh, he was already remanded, but he would be further remanded for a hearing. So I think he was just taken out of federal prison, guys. But beginning in September 2012, he would be incarcerated at the United States Penitentiary in Indiana. And in 2013, a federal judge ruled that he was mentally competent when he gave up his right to appeal his death sentence. But psychiatrists working with prosecution would diagnose Duncan with pedophilia, sadistic personality disorder, and antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic traits, but did maintain that he was legally sane. Those are some pretty heavy mental disorders, and I'm not sure that it shouldn't have been identified sooner that this was the case. It went through a lot of rigmarole, guys. There was petitions to, you know, a writ of habeas corpus. There was just lots of appeals, and it didn't end well for anyone, because at the end of the day, in 2017, it was ordered that the government's third motion for extension of time would be granted and denied in part, and the governor's response was due in October of 2017. It all ended with him still having the death penalty and him sitting in federal prison. But in January of 2007, the same day that he'd been indicted for federal court, Riverside County officials announced that he would be charged with Anthony Martinez's murder. Now, they wanted to extradite him back to California. There was even an appeal from the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, but the federal trial proceeded. Excuse me. I'm so sorry. Now, in 2009, 5 months after being sentenced to death by the federal courts, he would be extradited back to California, and he pled guilty to Martinez's murder, and he'd be sentenced to life terms. But as a part of his plea deal, the sentence came without the possibility of parole or a right to appeal. So although Joseph could have faced a separate death sentence in addition to the ones he'd already faced in federal court, the Riverside County, they justified that the life sentence, they consulted the family and the federal system, and what they'd agreed was the federal system is going to kill him long before the state of California could have even thought about it. But in 2016, Shasta Grooney, she was only 19 years old at this stage. She started a petition called the Slade and Dillon's Law in honor of her two brothers. Now, in this petition, she would state that convicted sex offenders should not be let out of jail. Now, what this meant was that the three-strike rule should not apply to violent sex offenders. It should be reduced to one strike. Now, by the time the petition was closed, it had around 52,000 supporters. I don't know if that went ahead, guys, but, you know, I truly believe in that. I do think. One strike rule. If you're a violent sex offender, never let out of jail. Now, in October 2020, Joseph underwent brain surgery as he was diagnosed with brain cancer, and he declined any treatment and rejected chemotherapy or radiation, and he had about 6 to 12 months to live, and in March 28, 2021, he would die at the age of 58. Now, again, guys, a death too quick. I'm hoping he suffered at least a little bit with brain cancer. I really, really do hope he suffered. But guys, thank you all for listening to episode 10, and I can't believe I'm at 10 episodes already. That's pretty exciting. But if you do like this podcast, please hit that like button, subscribe. Please hit anything that you need to make sure that you get notified of any new episodes. But have a great weekend, my fellow peanuts. I hope you have a great one. Bye.